This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today on Cool Science Radio, we explore one of the defining questions of our time. Will artificial intelligence weaken democracy or help save it? Our guest is Beth Simone Novak. She's a professor and director of the Burn Center for Social Change at Northeastern University and one of the world's leading voices on technology, governance, and civic innovation.
In her new book, Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy, Novak argues that democracy's challenges are not just political. They're design problems. Drawing on work from Obama White House to governments around the globe, she shares how AI could help defend elections, improve public services, and make governments more responsive and inclusive if we choose to build those systems for public good rather than concentrated power. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So your book, it opens with a pretty stark claim. Democracy is in retreat, and our institutions are more broken now than ever. But rather than blaming technology, you argue AI could actually save democracy. That feels a little counterintuitive, considering a lot of people right now associate AI with misinformation, surveillance, and even manipulation. What's the most important thing you want our listeners to actually think about before they even open the book?
Well, I hope they'll open the book, of course. But if they do open it, what I hope to point out and what I hope they'll learn is that a lot of what we read about in the headlines, a lot of what we're hearing about, the AI apocalypse, right? The robots are coming to take all of our jobs. They're going to destroy the planet. They're going to upend life as we know it. And truly, we're living in a time of tremendous and tumultuous change. But these are tools. Like the word processors and calculators before them, AI isn't going to do anything by itself, so to speak. It's how we use it. So in the same way that you can use nuclear as power to heat and cool our communities, or you can use it to wage war, AI is a tool, and it's how we use it. So what I want people to take away is that we are not passive victims in this story. We can be proactive actors focusing on making the right investments, making the right choices, and thinking hard about how we use these tools to do things in the right way. So I don't want to discount the seriousness of some of the challenges you've mentioned, misinformation, disinformation. Everybody's heard about deepfakes. But we're sometimes missing the story about the good things that we can do with these things. So, and that's what I'm hoping that we can get into and that people are focusing on and that we can talk about what each of us can also do, not just governments, but also each of us as individuals.
Well, your work history is fascinating. And I want to point out, you probably didn't start your career thinking about AI and democracy. You've created one of the first platforms online for democratic deliberation called, I believe, UnChat, if I'm saying that correctly.
That's right.
And then Peer2Patton, which connects scientists with policymakers to improve the patent system. I'm just curious, how did those early experiments shape the ideas in this book? And what surprised you the most when they actually worked?
Well, you're right that none of us were thinking about AI a few years ago. Some people were, but now all of us, we can't get away from it. It's all you hear about. It's all you talk about. It's really hard not to think about it. But what got me started on this project was really thinking about democracy and really going back even further. When I was a student, I had the wonderful experience, you know, we got to do a summer abroad somewhere, and I was trying to decide between topics and decided, ooh, wouldn't it be fun to go to Vienna and sit in coffee houses and eat cake and study what happened in Vienna and Austria and in Germany between the wars. Why did this fledgling democracy after World War I devolve into fascism, dictatorship, and Nazism? So I became interested very, very early on in these questions of what makes some institutions, democratic institutions, work well and survive stress and challenge, and what makes some institutions break. So fast forward, and I'm a first generation child of the web, if you will. The internet is much older, but the web and the commercial internet is really part of my upbringing. And so I was very interested early on, and that's how we ended up starting UnChat, was creating the first platform for communities to talk among themselves and to have a deliberative conversation about an issue, to run an online class and be able to get a group together from around the world. And what was fun about that project was it wasn't just talking online. That was something we all knew about chat from a very early time. There were chat rooms in those days. It was called Unchat, precisely because we were creating a structured way for people to have a conversation. The cool thing at that time, and this is now and back in 99, that's almost 30 years ago, was the functionality for moderating the conversation. The controls you would see on your screen would pass from user to user to user. So the person who had the control over the microphone would circulate among the users in the room by virtue of having the democratic, the shared opportunity to participate in running the conversation. You became a better participant in the conversation. So it was really one of the first pieces of software that was thinking about this intersection between tech and democracy. And that's really how I got my start. And now fast forward, here we are with AI, and the possibilities are limitless.
You know, it's funny, Beth, that those who are most heavily involved in AI from every aspect of it are the ones who are most optimistic about it. And yet, as you say, we can't, as the public, we can't just sit back and wait for it to happen to us, that we need to have an active role. Going back, I know it was a long time ago when you sat in a coffee house in Vienna, but just last night I finished a World War II book about the agony and the in Northern Italy that was experienced during World War II. And I keep going back to, how did that happen? How did that happen? So can you tie in that story for us about—
Maybe it's men like the Roman Empire and women like World War II. I don't know what it is, but we all have our historical fascinations. And what happened a lot at the time, and I'll tell you, and then let me bring it forward into what we want to talk about with science and tech today, was you had a set of really institutional actors at that point. I mean, there's a lot to say about, and depending on your view of history, and I'm not getting into the question of, you know, evil people like Hitler and the influence of one person, but in addition to the single leader theory that a lot of people ascribe to, you had a set of institutions, both on the left and the right. It wasn't just an issue of which political party. Both sides of the political spectrum had these very, very rigid political structures. It was highly, highly partisan. You were either in my camp or you were my enemy. A lot sounds similar to today. We live in an age in which more people would agree to marry somebody of a different religion than they would of a different political party. We live in these very hyper-partisan political times. We have rising tide of political violence. This is not, again, an issue of left or right. It's on both sides of the aisle. And you had something very similar in that period in terms of this just really entrenched camp mentality where it was like my way or the highway. And that kind of fragility, that lack of bipartisanship, of, as we would call it in our terms today, they had more political parties than do. But, you know, if we think about it as left and right, was really what contributed to the system sort of breaking down. That and, of course, hyperinflation and the economic consequences of World War I, the guilt that we heaped upon them, the blame. So there's lots to say about sort of why that system broke, and depends on your which historians you read. But I think going forward today, we've set up something similar. And I would disagree a little bit that there is a great deal of optimism even among those people who are builders of these technologies. In fact, some of the most negative narratives, and we have to ask why, are pushed by those people who do the building, those people who created these technologies. But we have created these two poles, and the media loves kind of these extreme headlines. Mm-hmm. You know, headline one, the world is ending, AI apocalypse, AI is going to come for our jobs, AI is going to take over humanity, it's going to start, you know, doing things for us, and we are going to become slaves to this technology. So you have some version of that. We have a version of that also with social media and what's happening to our kids. So it's a very, very negative story about tech. Or you have this very hyper-positive economic development story, which is about how we in the U.S. have to beat China at the economic race for AI dominance. And it's going to create jobs, and it's going to create innovation, et cetera. There's this sort of messy middle that we don't talk about a lot. You know, things happening in Utah, for example, where the state has gone out and for free built its own tool to help lawyers in the state review contracts, so that a lawyer, for example, working for a contracting officer working for the state of Utah can now very, very rapidly check a contract to make sure it complies with Utah statutes, to make sure that it complies with the law there. And the state says it saves contract analysts 75% of their time. That means more contracts getting read, more businesses getting approved for deals. That means more jobs and savings of taxpayer dollars. So that's the kind of almost in the weeds story. And for example, sticking with Utah for a moment, you know, where they have rolled out Gemini to employees all across the state, there's lots happening to use AI, but not what citizens are necessarily seeing, because we're not replacing humans. You know, when you call to answer the phone, you're still getting a human, thank goodness, who's answering it. But the human answering the phone has a tool that's helping them to get better answers faster. So my students, for example, in a fellowship program we run called AI for Impact, they built a tool for the state of Massachusetts to help the, when you call to get health insurance from your state exchange, the person answering the phone has an AI tool that helps them look across 250 different documents and policies so that you can get an answer faster. What does that mean? You get an accurate answer, you get a faster answer, you're not waiting on hold, and it means government works better. So bringing this back together, you know, the dysfunction we were talking about before with regard to effective governance and flexible, agile governance, that matters just as much now as it did then. And that's what is part of the story that I'm trying to tell, is kind of shining some light on some of these early uses that are really exciting. And if we make the right investments, I think we can have a lot more of that will lead to more effective institutions, which in turn may cause rates of trust in government and trust in democracy to increase. Because right now, they couldn't be lower, especially right. Among young people. We're talking 7%, you know, Congress, president, doesn't matter. And again, doesn't matter your political party. It's the rates of trust in our institutions are way too low. And that's what's leading to perceive problems and problems with our elections, how our government agencies run, how we talk to one another, how we solve our problems, and the things we kind of think about in this broad bucket called democracy.
It may be sort of simplistic, Beth, to say that AI, if we do it right, will help humans be good at what humans are good at and allow them to shine in these human tasks, and let them use these AI tools to just make it more efficient so that you always get a human dealing with that you're dealing with on the phone when you call. Hopefully that sort of thing increases trust. But I wanted to make sure that we talked about elections, because both, no matter which side you're on, you always think, you know, it's always being told to us that the other side is somehow rigging elections. And that, I mean, elections is really, you know, it is the center of democracy.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how AI can help?
Sure. And of course, and I don't want to minimize, and it is a good thing that 49 states now have some version of a law against deepfakes, right? The idea that you can impersonate someone, whether, and so we've seen malevolent uses both in the election context, but also in the sort of sexual context. This is not new with AI. We have, you know, had some version of deepfakes of somebody cutting and pasting and photocopying something or doing that with older technologies. But the robocalls, the impersonating people, the disinformation at scale is obviously something that we worry about. And I don't want to minimize that at all. Just in the interest of time, I want to focus on some of the good things for a moment. And that's what I mean about where we're focusing our attention. Because if we're only talking about a defensive posture, if we only stop with, let's fight the deepfakes and we think we're done, then we're not doing what we need to do what I think is our shared priority. Again, doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican or something else, we all should care about the health and well-being of our democracy and believe in our integrity of our democracy. Free, fair, and frequent elections is what we typically think of. So for example, there is software that is being used. 25 states now use AI-powered software to conduct what is called entity resolution to ensure that the people on the voter rolls are not just real people, but the right people, and that we're ensuring that when we have the right, that we're maintaining people's right to vote. So, for example, you move states, and here, maybe Scott, you're called Scott in one state, and in another state, you're called, I don't know, do you have a middle name? Maybe it's easier. The example works better with John and Jack, which can easily get confused. I don't know if Scott is short for something. Scottiferous. But you can see how you can get lost in between two databases. And so whether it's the right to vote or whether it's the right to a school meal for a kid so they don't go hungry, AI is being used in a lot of places. And we want to make those investments to ensure that we are correctly maintaining those voter rolls. In Brazil, for example, when you go into the voting booth, they used AI synthesized voices to read you your ballot so that if you are visually impaired, if you are elderly and can't see your ballot very well, if you are blind, you can vote independently and exercise your right to vote. In India and Kenya, they're using biometric systems, using AI, again, to ensure identity of voters and ensure integrity in their voting system. And then you have lots of examples all over the world of candidates now turning to the simple AI tools that we all have access to now to create campaign posters, multilingual campaign content. Imagine you live in India where there are 22 different languages and you are a less well-resourced candidate. You can now translate all of your materials into 22 languages. Or you just want to run for office because you're, you know, Lynn decides she's been reading about World War II. She's worried about the fate of democracy. She's now going to run for town council where she lives. How are you going to go up against somebody with a lot more money and power and resources? You can't afford a fancy consultant. But now, maybe with generative AI, you can make a poster, you can make an ad, you can make a commercial, you can compete on a more level playing field. So that's just some examples. And then we have lots of work in the disinformation space, too. A group like MeDon operates. It's a nonprofit operating in 53 different countries. They are using AI, and there's a lot of research from different universities in this space to spot and identify misinformation and disinformation so we can flag it sooner, flag it earlier, debunk it, and can do the research that we need to do to understand how to fight against disinformation and ensure more effective persuasion. So lots of great stuff happening, but I think the greatest threat to elections isn't that we're going to have AI that produces a deep fake. We haven't seen that yet. You've had lots of these impersonations and fake videos and whatnot. No evidence that, despite the panic, it's changed any elections. It's that we're not investing enough and thinking about how do I use AI to fix the voter rolls? How do I use AI to create simple training for poll workers? How do I use AI to register people who are not registered? How do I use AI to help more people run for office? That's what we want to be thinking about, the positive story to complement the negative.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are in a conversation with our guest, Beth Simon-Novak. She's a professor and director of the Burns Center for Social Change at Northeastern University. And she's one of the world's leading voices on technology, governance, and civic innovation. We're talking about her new book, Reboot AI and the Race to Save Democracy. You use in your work, throughout your work, democratic AI. And a lot of people might hear AI in government and imagine a cold algorithmic bureaucracy, robots deciding who gets benefits or who goes to jail. How do you distinguish democratic AI from a possible nightmare version? And what are the conditions that separate one from the other?
Well, let me state first of all that by democratic here, I'm talking democracy with a small d, not democratic versus Republican, but
right,
D
right.
For
yep.
Democracy, the thing we all care about, which is elections that are free and fair, government institutions that function, representative institutions that actually speak for us, and our ability to have some amount of participation in the decisions that affect us. And ultimately, you know, democracy is supposed to be about our own self-governance. How do we move towards a world in which we are more involved, have more say, and have more power over the decisions that impact us. So I deliberately use the term de-democratic as opposed to, first of all, just AI for good, which some people use, and it is a part of that. But AI for good also includes using AI to detect tumors in healthcare or using AI to fight climate change. There's lots of good things we want to do in the world. But I want to be very specific here about our ability, first and foremost, to create these more effective institutions that can do things like answer the phone faster, deliver a benefit more easily. And by the way, faster also translates into reduced cost and lower cost for taxpayers, but also more effective. Institutions, for example, that are using AI and its profound ability to help us do better research and get better information faster, so that we can do research on what's the best solutions to problems of whether it's climate or healthcare or traffic or whatever is the issue that we're facing in our community. We should have access to the best evidence and the best information about what works. And AI is really supercharging our ability, when we use it well, to be able to do that research faster and better. Think about it as like having 100 interns. Which generally are under-resourced public institutions and civic institutions can't afford to do. So it's about better information and how we make decisions. It's about more opportunities for us to participate and deliberate. You know, the web has given us 25 years of talking. Like, everybody can get on and create a YouTube video, as we know. Anyone can now go put their dance moves on TikTok. What it doesn't help with is listening. And in fact, the more people talk, the harder it is to listen. So I'm really excited about the ways in which institutions are now turning to AI to help them to listen better. So in Bowling Green, Kentucky, for example, they went out and asked the whole community. They wanted to make a 25-year plan for the future of the community, economic plan, what investments should we make, what kind of community do we want to live in? They went out and asked people. But when 8,000 people answer you, it becomes really, really hard to listen. So with the help of AI tools, they can summarize what they heard, they can organize the comments, they can put them in buckets and say, here's what people told us. State of California went out and did something similar after the wildfires that happened last year, those terrible wildfires. They launched a project called Engage California, and tens of thousands of people responded with how we could have done better. Again, tens of thousands of people respond. Really, really difficult to listen. That can take months and months and months, or would have taken months and months before. Now, because I can go out and use AI to help me summarize what people are saying, not only have they been able to turn those ideas into new policies, but they're continuing to go out and ask. So they just launched a new worker engagement. They just launched another citizen engagement. So lots of, I think, excitement, particularly in the space of what I would call participatory democracy, the opportunities for you and me to actually get involved. And last thing I'll just say here, I just testified on Capitol Hill, where I was invited by one of the committees to come and answer the question, how could Congress actually better listen? Because right now, what is the way in which you get to participate in what happens on Capitol Hill? There isn't. You vote for your congressperson once every 2 years, and that's about it. There is no way, even if you called your member of Congress, you know, take a number. You're lucky if anybody has time to answer the phone. The person answering the phone is probably a college intern. And you're sitting in a pile with literally 800,000 other phone calls, et cetera, that have come in. So the conversation on Capitol Hill was genuinely, and this was both Republicans and Democrats, asking, how do we actually do this? How would we use these tools? So we're right at the beginning of learning how to do this, but I think there's a lot of great examples. And short story long, that's what I mean by democratic AI, how to make our institutions work better and create better ways for us to participate in them.
This is absolutely fascinating. And again, I wish we had so much more time. I'm going to let you wrap up with something that I'm very interested in. I found out that you founded something called Innovate US, which is now described as the nation's largest AI training program for government workers. I would love to know what you think is the single most important thing a civil servant needs to understand about AI and how to use it well and how to use it for the benefit of the constituencies.
I think it's that we all need, civil servants or not, and by the way, everything on Innovate US is free, so anyone can use it. It's used by the state of Utah and its civil servants, but anyone can go there. We do 4 workshops a week. We have classes that you can take at your own pace. And the most important thing is what we learn what these tools are good at and what they're not good at. And especially understanding what the dangers are and what the risks are can help us to ensure that we are avoiding them, that we are not buying stupid tools that someone, you know, tells us will predict, you know, magically predict the future or magically solve all of our problems, but that we are actually understanding what they can and can't do and how we each can use them in our own job and in our own work. You know, very controversial topic right now is this issue of data centers, for example, and how much energy, water, electricity we should consume when using these AI tools requires a little bit of education. What's a data center? How is it different? An AI data center, what does that mean? So I think it's just really important that we all learn what these tools are and how we can use them, whether it's as a government worker, how to serve the public, whether it's for each of us as individuals, how we can use them to run for office, to organize our neighbors, to go clean up the park, to get involved, you know, to write to our congressperson or to write to our government, how we can use them for good, to help our kids better learn how to read. Lots of things we can do with these things. And so we want to be focused on the positive, proactive things we can do to take power and use the tools so that they serve us. AI on tap, not AI on top.
Beth Simone Novak's new book is Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy, published by the Yale University Press. You can read more of her work at rebootdemocracy.ai. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.